The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you want to learn how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/doubledocmd. For the month of October, we're going to be having a look at films about hauntings. Now, this means that most of our conversations are going to revolve around issues of physical and psychological trauma, abuse, and other forms of violence. If this material just isn't for you, that's totally fine. Feel free to skip this episode, and we'll catch you next time. Just wash it all, wash it all away. It will haunt you. You wear it well, wear that uncanny smile like you ought to.
Ladies and gentlemen, and all those from beyond, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Silvio Emery.
And I'm your co-host, Annie Neller.
And tonight we are cutting into the 1982 seminal horror classic Poltergeist, directed by Toby... Is it Tobe or Toby Hooper?
I think it's...
I don't actually know.
I think it's Toby. I think.
You think it's Toby?
Yeah.
I think it's Tobe. Let's agree to disagree there.
We'll call him Tobe.
Just because, like, Toby Hooper sounds kind of casual. Tobe Hooper sounds like a little bit more like an industry name, you know? Anyways.
Yeah, maybe.
Moving on. So let's talk about context for this one. We've been doing hauntings all month long, and this is one of the seminal classics. We wanted to go all the way back to 1962's, or is it 63's, The Haunting, but there are only so many weeks in a month, and we'll come back to that one eventually. But this one is cited as an inspiration for a lot of things. It was remade recently, so I thought it was important to come back to this one. But I have never seen this movie before. What about you, Annie? Do you have any kind of prior relationship to this film?
So apparently what I had thought was actually this film was The Exorcist. So no, I have never seen this film before until now.
I'm really wondering how you mix those two up.
I wish that I had a good response to that, something that made me sound like a learned adult, but I really don't. I just mistook the two movies, totally different titles, totally different topics, and apparently mixed them up somehow. So this was an interesting watch. It was not what I was expecting for that reason.
All right, that is fair enough. So let's, in that case, we don't really have much context for this. Let's just go straight into the review portion, and then we'll go into spoiler town and, you know, do our thing. Get real in the meaty greedy of this. Meaty greedy?
Nitty gritty?
Whatever.
Maybe not the meaty gritty.
I think I was trying to combine meat, like in the meat and nitty gritty, and it just didn't work. So forgive me, fair audience. Anyways, I'm going to go ahead and start with this one. I'm going to give this one an A-. The setup and the build-up in this film is fantastic, and I love, and I mean love, the first half of it. But the second half is paced kind of weirdly, and the third act drags a little bit for me. And it's just a pacing issue. I don't think there's anything wrong with it or there's any kind of error in intent. It's just a different standard of movies that they were pursuing.
Yeah.
And it's not a failing so much as it is a misalignment between me and the film.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go ahead and give this one a B+. I think that this movie is aesthetically beautiful, and it's clear that Spielberg and Hooper both have this really detailed eye for how they want to make things look, how they want to view things, and how they want the audience to see them. I do think the pacing issues in the last third of the movie really kind of took me out of it a tiny bit. So I kind of have a similar opinion, but I am going to go ahead and say that I do think that the writing issue is a writing issue. I think that it's a problem, and it's not really something that I can say is fine because of authorial intent. I think it's an actual pacing issue. So, yeah, this was a B+ okay. For me.
All right. So, because it's curious because we seem to be hitting slightly different notes in how we're approaching this, because I'm kind of looking at this as an artistic piece, whereas you're kind of looking at this, I think, almost more as entertainment or for modern consumption.
Yeah. I think that's definitely right.
I think we're basically in agreement. It's just kind of interesting that normally I'm kind of the entertainment guy and you're kind of the artsy one.
This is true.
So, ladies and gentlemen, our Freaky Friday episode. Anyways, let's just go right ahead and get into mechanics then. This is good. So, everyone, spoilers for Poltergeist, a, what is it, 36-year-old movie now at this point?
I think more? So. Maybe it's probably older than that. I'd have to do math, though, and wait. You know that I'm a humanities person, not a math person.
No, it's 36 years. I'm reasonably confident, and this is a podcast. This is going to last forever, so.
It is.
Eventually, I'll be right, or eventually, I'll be wrong. Either way. So, let's start with you, Annie. What jumped out, like, what's the first thing you want to talk about? Like, just mechanically what this film does and, I don't know, good or bad?
Good or bad. Oh, God. There's so much going on in this film that it's almost difficult to choose a place to start. I guess we could start at the beginning, because this movie starts out playing the Star Spangled Banner over a montage of images of national monuments in Washington, D.C. And that comes back on while the family is sleeping at one point. And I'm wondering, what is that doing? What does that mean?
For God's sake, Annie, the deep cuts go at the end of the podcast. Well,
I don't know. I think this could end up being a lot of deep cuts because
there's so much content. Yeah, but one of the things that kind of evokes for me, and this is one thing I think did very well, is weirdly enough, I feel like this movie isn't as timeless as critics have always considered it to be.
No.
I think 10 years ago you could have said that, but, you know, maybe. With the switch over to digital TV, with a lot of things that have changed, I'm not sure it's timeless anymore. Which just kind of goes to show, our modern world is changing and rotating so quickly. I don't know what that voice was.
That was like 50s car commercial announcer.
And it comes with bucket seats.
No, like this is definitely a period piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do like that, though, because that does establish kind of the time of it very quickly. Because here's the thing, we're both millennials. We're born in, like, you know, 91, 90, I think is the, mm-hmm. between the two of us. Mm-hmm. And so this is absolutely a time that kind of predates us, but there were trace elements of this. And also this idea of, you know, the movie box as being something that turned itself off and went to snow after a while. That's something that was in media during our childhood.
Right. Yeah.
It was a reality we were coming out of with cable and all that, but it was a reality that we were familiar with, even though we didn't experience ourselves. So having that be a important part of the kind of aesthetic establishment of this movie really grounded that very efficiently and very quickly for me. And it's weird to say that because this, I don't feel, is a deliberate choice. This, I think, is just reflecting the realities of the time. But in retrospect, it becomes, like, if you made this movie today and it came out exactly the same, this would have been a brilliant directorial choice.
The static? Itself, like,
not just the static, not just the static, but the this is the end of our broadcast day shit.
Because
that's what that is, the with the monuments and the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah, because I have to admit, I do think that's very intentional. Like the choice of it being the end of the day, the choice of it going to static. I think that is fully intentional. It's not just a part of the period. We can get to that a little later, though.
All right. Well, hold up. I might as well just a little bit of a deep cut here. Just a little bit. But
small incision.
If I want to look at where that is thematically, this means that this whole movie kind of takes place when society is asleep and when society isn't functioning. Because, again, this is, you know, 1982. This is, I mean, I'm sure there were 24-hour traders somewhere, but, like, this is before the internet. This is before.
Oh, yeah.
There really was anything.
This is resembling before a society there wasn't in the nighttime, downtime.
You know. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, what happens. Okay, hold on. Let me throw up a big poetic phrase for the box. You know, this is what happens between the breaths of society. There we go.
Okay. I'll allow it.
Am I up my own ass enough yet, Annie?
We've still got, you know what, like an hour to go, so there's still more there's more time.
All right, cool. So I actually love the use of light in this movie, and particularly it's kind of an inversion that I like, because light is very often in this movie menacing, even metaphorical lights, you know, step towards the light, stay out of the light, stay right. out of the light.
Right.
It's, it represents, in some ways, you know, life and continuance and closure, but it also represents permanence. And so, like, if you want to get weird about it, it's kind of Schrodinger-y, is like, once something is revealed, it becomes real. And while we're in the dark, we can still kind of tweak and try and make things better. You know, I think that's a bit of a stretch, but
I don't think so. I think that's about, you know, light makes things visible, right? Once you can see something, you can name it, you can categorize it, you can do all the sorts of things that the suburbs and in general society tells you that you should do when you see a thing.
So. Oh, no, no. I've just made a connection here, Annie.
Uh-oh.
If they call the cops, their daughter is really missing.
Yeah, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
I think I have stumbled into something here. Oh. So speaking of that, which, that's another thing that I actually really liked about this compared to a lot of like 80s horror I've seen, is there are some good fucking parents.
Right. Yeah, the parenting's actually okay in this one. Not everyone's yelling like, at each other.
Yeah, but like, it's weird that that's so, I mean, it's not weird because, you know, stories are about conflict, and conflict at home is very relatable. It's something that's easy to sell, and it's something that's easy to use to set up further conflict later.
But the 80s were all about that, right? Like, think about John Hughes. Hughes' work explores the differences between generations, between parents and their kids. That's also what Home Alone is about. Home Alone is about times where parents don't listen to their kids or forget about them. So that sort of difference is kind of built into 80s film. So yeah, it actually is pretty interesting that these people are fairly good parents, and that this is not just a nuclear family, it's a cohesive family at the beginning of the film.
Yeah. Actually, I do want to ask a question. Were they rolling tobacco or marijuana in bed? Because I can't tell.
I actually don't know. There's a lot of cigarettes that you could have rolled with loose paper during the 80s, but I thought it might have been weed.
Yeah, but there were also, I think, plenty of, you know, machine-pressed mass-production cigarettes in the film, so I feel like that's a deliberate contrast.
Yeah.
I don't know, because that is actually, that's one of my favorite scenes, is where Steve's just together. Being goofy in bed and yeah. doing his Olympic diver thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because that's one thing, because I'm not sure what the perspective is. I think this is a family perspective. I think that's the best way to describe it, because we have both the kind of childhood perspectives of fear with, like, you know, the clown and so on, but you also have, like, these adult perspectives of relationship, because when you see a lot of movies are made for kids or made to be accessible to kids. And parents in particular, I think, are always presented as this kind of serious, grim unit. It's like, if they have any kind of levity, generally, it's because they're playing with their children. And there's not much reserved, at least in my kind of, you know, zeitgeist understanding of cinema, that parents are silly and playful and loving with each other. You know, it's that kind of classic, you know, the joke is like, ah, the old ball and chain, huh? But, like, there is an affection, there is a silliness, and there is a goofiness there that reminds me of, like, my own relationship with my spouse, like, you know. So that was, I think, actually one of my favorite scenes in the film.
Okay, I just checked on IMDb about this because I wanted to confirm it. And yes, it is weed, and they discovered it in a drawer at their house and decided to smoke it. So it's basically implied that it was probably there for a while, and they've chosen to smoke it. Interesting. Actually, you know what? That is really interesting. Because this is around the time where, historically, and this is outside the text of the film, where we start to see Nancy Reagan pushing her anti-drug campaign later on. So there's something sort of interesting about that, because it's a call back to both drug culture of the 1970s, but it's also happening in this period where, like, you're about to go into the drug wars with Reagan. So it's kind of an interstitial moment. It's funky.
There is a connection there, because they found that in, like, a cigar box.
Yeah.
Which I think is is the exact same cigar box that they bury the bird in. I also like, I like the bird for a couple reasons. I think the scene is okay. The setup it does for, you know, for Carol Ann to be, you know, the creepy prophecy child is great. But one thing I really like is the foreshadowing of the dog digging up the box.
Yeah.
Because that's what this whole movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
Or also, you know, Robbie saying, you know, when it's rots, can we dig it up so when it's a skeleton? I mean, it's kind of on the nose once you know it's there.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's a great, like, just very small detail.
Yeah. So what else is kind of striking mechanically for you?
One of the scenes that I really, really like is when the one guy who's in the sort of, like, Ghostbusters crew, if you will, goes into the kitchen and has this spectral vision of a steak filled with maggots, and then goes into the bathroom and his face just gets absolutely destroyed, and then he wakes up and realizes that it's this vision. It's a beautifully and disturbingly well shot scene, and I found it particularly effective, or I guess affecting would be a better word to use here. I found it just freaking terrifying.
Well, would you say that it is effective and affecting?
Yeah.
There we go. But I actually want to call, and this is the animator in me speaking.
Yeah.
To a specific detail. First of all, I want to clarify, he sees the steak crawl across the counter, and I say crawl very specifically there, but then it erupts in, like, meat and, like, chicken organs, I think, and then he drops the piece of chicken that he's eating and sees that there are maggots in it. Just to clarify, the meat doesn't have the maggots.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so there's a kind of a weird contrast here, because the model of his head that he's ripping apart is very obviously fake,
at least
for me. It's still somewhat horrifying in the violence of it, but it's not like, it's that Saw effect where, like, oh, I know this isn't a real human face. This is not like Jan Svankmajer or some shit.
Yeah.
But the meat, on the other hand, is beautifully done. It's just a steak sliding across the counter. And you can tell that it's not just, like, you know, a fishing line tied to a corner of the steak and dragging it slowly. It's actuated at two different points. It squashes and stretches. So it crawls. It moves like some kind of slug. And I love it. It is such a fantastic shot. And the shot after that where the meat's coming up out of it, that's clearly there's a hole in the counter and they're pushing it up through it. So there's a lot of setup for that really simple shot.
Yeah, I just really like that whole sequence. I don't know, like, there's something about it that was kind of terrifying to me, despite the fact that it's so camp.
Yeah.
I don't really
You know what? This does lead me to something I like, is I like the house, but most of all, I like the kitchen. The kitchen is such a good set, and they put it to such good use. I think probably the first shot that they really, like, use it really masterfully in is the chair stacking. And it's such a slow build-up to that point, because you start with, you know, breakfast.
Yeah.
You start with the chairs, like, tuck these chairs in. And then, you know, the glass breaking into the cereal. Which, by the way, very sudden, unexpected, good shock. Good,
yeah.
Like, sharp tap to the system.
Yeah.
But then she asks Carol Ann, you know, did you pull out these chairs? And she says no. She sits up on the counter, they turn there, and then the camera turns back and the chairs are stacked like cups.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a seamless cut, at least for me. I'm sure if I go frame by frame, maybe I can catch something, but I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
And, like, the kind of sudden start that they get, it's wonderfully done. And they play with that space very well. And then later it becomes, like, their kind of, like, chalky playground where they learn to slide across the floor.
Yeah.
It's cool. And I think... It's also, I think, kind of appreciable for me, a especially in contrast to kind of modern trends, because the second she put on a helmet, the modern filmmaker in me thinks, okay, cool, so someone's going to sit there and have their head shoved through a wall. You know? Yeah. And, like, I wasn't expecting it at that moment. I was expecting it maybe later in the film. And I'm kind of glad that didn't happen. But, like, it's kind of, I think, a contrast in the expectations of this film. No one actually really gets that fucked up in this movie.
No. They don't.
I mean, people get fucked up, but no one gets, like, injured or killed, really.
Yeah, or, like, maimed or anything like that. Because this film hinges on the threat of violence to the family itself, not actual bodily harm, right?
Yeah, because, like, one of I think, the scariest props for me was the compass. First of all, playing a record with a compass, brilliant moment. But also, like, the threat of a sharp object flying at your face. That is as close as we come to bodily harm in this movie. And now that I think about, like, that's really weird. Like, I don't think I've seen many movies that are, you know, this scary or this tense without bodily harm.
Yeah, and I think that's partly due to, like, what you were saying about modern conventions. Like, now there's so many different films that you can pull on in the horror genre, a lot of which are more dependent on gore, or, like, we have a fascination with bodies coming apart and that sort of disfigurement thing. This movie, though, because it's so much about a white family in the suburbs, it hinges on the threat of violence and not necessarily actual violence itself. So, I can kind of see it both ways, in a way.
Yeah. And I just checked, actually, this film is PG, so...
Well, they negotiated it down from R, somehow.
Okay, they must have cut a lot, though, because, like, I would say, like, the face-ripping scene alone warrants a PG-13.
There wasn't actually a PG-13 rating at the time when this film was released. That's a bit more of a recent thing. So there was a PG and an R. Yeah, it's also why you'll find quite a few PG movies from the 1980s that contain, say, the F word. Or, like,
okay,
a bunch of other swears.
Because that's the thing. I would say, you know, between PG and R, I'd say this is closer to PG. But between PG-13 and PG, this is way into PG-13. So that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Do you know what year that was instituted? Because I don't actually remember.
I don't remember either. I think it's during the 90s. If I remember right.
Oh.
One of the other things that I really liked about this movie was a sort of bodily adjustment of Craig T. Nelson's character, Steve Freeling, to the poltergeist. He goes from being this really confident guy who wears suits and he's well put together and all this stuff, and is playful with his wife, to being this man who sits at home in cardigans and a t-shirt and pants, like, slightly more disheveled with giant circles under his eyes. I really liked the way that they portrayed the strain of this event on him. I don't know what the makeup department was doing or what Craig T. Nelson was doing, but it works really well.
I mean, obviously it was that devil lettuce.
Of course, it was the devil lettuce. Devil lettuce, yeah, made them do it.
You know what was weird for me?
Mm-mm.
And I think this is one of those things that kind of checked me out of the last sequence, is JoBeth Williams as Diane. She's very much a mom character throughout most of the film, but in that last section, you know, she's, you know, taking a bath, she's, like, you know, getting ready for bed, and then she spends, like, the last third act without any pants on, and it feels very much more like that, like, I feel like she's portrayed much closer to what you'd say is, you know, an archetype of, like, teen horror, or, like, you know,
the girl
alone at home, or during,
yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
And so, like, there's kind of a paradigm shift on her, I guess, wardrobe choices that's kind of weird, especially because she does that scene where she's, like, you know, attacked on the bed and goes around the ceiling, which, by the way, brilliant shot. I think rotating set,
yeah,
set camera.
Yeah.
But when she's on the bed and she's, like, bucking her hips against, like, it just feels like very sexual imagery, and it's just...
It's
a hard gear shift,
yeah,
and I feel like that one grinds a little bit. Grinds.
Yeah, no, that whole sequence is very uncomfortable, but also, you're right, it's in a different tone, and it's almost within a different genre of horror film than this... the previous bits of the movie have been, so yeah, it doesn't quite work the same. Another thing I thought we could talk about are the parapsychology team who comes in.
I like
them. Because I really liked them. I liked all of them. I wanted to see more from them. Like, yeah. I really liked Beatrice Strait as Dr. Lesh, specifically. There's something kind of really caring and warm about her, and she's also very self-reflexive about her practice as a parapsychologist. She knows that people probably don't take her seriously at times because of what she does, but still, she's damn good at her job. And then we have the other members of the team. We've got Marty, played by Martin Casella. And we have Richard Lawson as Ryan, who is the only black character in this film. I loved
Richard Lawson in this. He didn't have a lot of lines, but he had a really strong on-screen presence. I think my favorite scene is with him is where he's sitting there drawing while the camera is shifting unknowingly.
Yeah.
And weirdly enough, like, I like that everyone smokes a lot in this, just mm-hmm. because, like, normally I'm just like, whatever, it was the 80s, it was the 70s, everyone's smoking like a goddamn chimney. But here, what I've noticed is smoking denotes comfort and ease.
Yeah.
And normality.
Yeah.
So, like, when the supernatural shit is flying off the handle, no one's smoking. So when he's sitting there, and I think he's smoking in the scene, I could be wrong, but it betrays a comfort, which makes the anticipation of supernatural shit happening, because we, the audience, can see something that he cannot, even better.
The other character who I wanted to talk about was Zelda Rubinstein, whom I liked from the first moment she walked out on screen. Like, I would want to see a movie with Zelda Rubinstein or Rubinstein playing this character with these other parapsychologists. She was fascinating to watch. And the movie is doing some interesting and very problematic things with her height, because she's a little person. But what's there in the dialogue is really pretty fascinating, and we get the feeling that she has this more extensive backstory.
Apparently, they brought her back for the sequels, so there was some love for that. But, yeah, I didn't know how to feel, because I do feel she was very much otherized from the very beginning. She
definitely was.
But I also really liked her performance, and I haven't seen any other of her work, so I can't tell if that is her natural speaking voice or if that is an affectation, but either way, it's interesting. Like, I don't want to kind of comment further and talk about how cool or how interesting of a choice it is without, you know, checking that that isn't just how she talks.
Right.
So either as a casting decision or as a acting decision, it brought something to the film, certainly. But she does have a very otherworldly feel to her, and I feel like I don't quite give her a fair shake in this movie, because I think once she is introduced, that is kind of the first nail in the coffin of this movie for me.
Okay.
Because that is when they start to take control, and it starts to become combative rather than anticipatory. And it's still interesting, but I think part of it is just the authority she exudes, and she's...
That's kind of what I liked really about that. Yeah.
I do like that about her. Yeah. I'm not sure I like that in this film.
Okay.
Because a big part of, I think, the emotional note for the family is bewilderment, is they don't know what's going on. Where is my daughter? Bring my little girl back. You know, Caroline, can you hear me? You know, leave the TV on. They're playing a game that they don't know the rules to. And when she comes in, she knows the rules. She goes upstairs. Where are they? They're in there. She is beyond this world. There is a demonic presence that has her. It's like she has answers. And she provides a degree of security and a degree of practicality that I think does not quite serve this film well.
Okay.
Because even the tech team, so to speak, which, by the way, I love, because I love, like, old AV equipment and all the oscilloscopes and crap.
Uh-huh.
I love that shit. Yeah. Like, that is my jam. Anything drawn by Shiro Masamune, like, I like to call it, like, oscilloscope punk. I fucking love it. But, like, even they, they are supposed experts in their field, but they're blown away by the absolute scale and obviousness of this haunting. So they're kind of in the dark as well, in that they're like, we never expected anything like this. This is way more than we signed up for. But I feel like Tangina does not have that problem. And so in a weird way, and I think that kind of plays into the casting choice and, you know, choosing to portray a little one as this, you know, powerful psychic or empath or however you want to describe her. Medium, I think, might be another word.
Yeah, but medium might be a better.
Because she has the knowledge and everyone else, I think, kind of has the bodily autonomy to execute her design.
Yeah.
And in a way, it also, I feel like she's portrayed as a little bit manipulative.
Yeah, she definitely is in the screenplay. Like, that comes out in that last scene, especially where Steve is trying to get his wife to come back through that giant rift thing, and he realizes that Tangina is telling them, go towards the light, and he's like, no, don't do that. So I'm not really sure. I don't know, it kind of almost seems like there's a misunderstanding of what she's trying to do there. And that's how it's read as manipulative.
My read of that scene is that she is taking the opportunity to try and, you know, call down the number of restless spirits as doing, and she is trusting Diane to, you know, take Carol Ann and hold her fast against the tide of this until they can pull them out. But even so, like, understanding that to be the plan, it still feels deceptive in that it kind of feels like they're being used as bait.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
But though, on the whole, I think the performances in this are great. The set design is great. I actually really love the I love that they have the empty house for contrast.
Mm-hmm.
That is a great decision there.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite shot in the whole film is when Steve is hanging out with his boss talking about a promotion and setting up a new house on the hill, and they're hanging around a fence, and then you cut to a wide shot that shows them, and this is a matte painting, I think, and it just shows them standing on the hill, and after this entire, like, 5-minute long conversation, you see that they're standing next to a massive graveyard. It's such a beautiful shot. I love it.
Yeah, that is also my favorite shot in this film, so I'm glad you pointed it out. It's a great moment, too, in the movie.
Yeah. Although, part of my brain sees that shot, because I took a screenshot because I wanted to post about it on Twitter, but also because, like, I was thinking about it. It's not going to make the cover of the episode. It's just not suitable. But while I just had that screenshot on my screen, I'm just sitting there and looking at it and thinking, the Cliffs of Insanity! Because that is the moment he's going for, is he's kind of having a realization.
Yeah. Inconceivable, right?
Okay, where can we fit him into this?
Somehow.
I think we can start going into some deep cuts here.
Yeah, probably.
First things first, this movie is about white suburbia, because of course it is. but specifically, it does actually seem to strike, and this strikes me as being odd for the period, but it is decidedly, like, anti-colonialist, is this idea of white suburbia as an encroaching power that is, I don't think it's this, like, it's kind of individualized to, you know, the greedy real estate magnate as really the source of evil, but it's still kind of implicit that white suburbia is a conquering force.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good description of it, especially, like, this is made fairly explicit, actually, in the scene that you just referenced. The boss who's talking to Steve says, well, you know, like, this isn't some, quote-unquote, Indian burial ground, these are just people. Which is particularly interesting because the grammar of that sentence implies that Native Americans aren't people. But I think on top of that, also, the whole movie's premise is that suburbia is built on the backs of the dead. And I think that's where it does some of its most interesting work. It doesn't really have much more to say about that than it, that other than you shouldn't do this because the dead will come back at you. And also the family doesn't really do a huge amount to improve the situation other than attempting to get their child back, partly because they can't, right? So I don't know. There's a part of me that definitely does see a sort of anti-colonial pushback, I suppose, but it's limited in scope.
Yeah, it is. And 82, it's hard to sell that at this point. But what I find kind of interesting there is it's not so much that, because I like I said, I think the evil, quote unquote, is kind of individualized into Steve's boss, but because it seems to me, if you want to go by the text and especially by the dialogue of the film, the sin is not that they built it otherwise. It's that they didn't move them properly. It's not that they encroach on that space. It's that they didn't do it properly. And, you know, it's that they cut corners. It's that they didn't do it the way that they said that they would do it. It is the deception and the lie rather than the act itself.
Right, which makes it actually worse. But Steve also does say to his boss, like, burial ground is sacred, implying that all funerary sites are sacred, and so to transgress on those is to violate an interdiction, according to Steve. So there's two interdictions being violated. It's not just they built this over the burial ground, like I said, it's, as you say, they didn't properly rebury people afterward. They just moved the headstones. So it's multiple interdictions, not just one.
I mean, I think part of the function of it is to absolve Steve, because he is, you know, as indicated, a big part of the success of this suburb. You know, he has sold all the houses. I actually, would this be a suburb or a development at this point? I don't actually know. I think it's probably a development, which becomes a suburb, obviously.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it.
Because, and this is something I think that the film just doesn't grapple with, is kind of, you know, complicity. Is Steve is part of the problem, and in like a more nuanced, like, if we were examining this, for example, as a real event, then we would look at the fallout, we would look at, you know, what does Steve do after this, because this is, a lot of this is predicated on Steve not knowing, but the scope of the film isn't so much that we can see kind of what he does in the long term with that knowledge. So, you know, there's, you know, if I had to guess, you know, lawsuits, maybe some dismantling, whatever, I don't know. Yeah, sure, Poltergeist 2, Steve gets the lawyer and sues them, whatever, I don't care. But
I'm also thinking, too, about that last moment before the titles roll at the end of the film, in which Steve pushes the TV out of the hotel room, which implies that the TV was part of the central problem of how these creatures entered into the house. And that's part of a larger discussion that was going on in the 80s and 90s about violence in television. And also there were conspiracy theories about, obviously, as there always were, about antagonistic forces attempting to use TV, white noise, that sort of stuff, to gain access to people or to hypnotize them, that sort of thing.
MK Ultra, baby!
Yeah, so that's also going on in the meantime. We should also probably talk about children, too, right? Because this is a film that's fundamentally about people's fears that they will fail their children somehow. And it'll be in a way that they won't be able to understand or navigate without help. So what do we think is going on there?
You say that, and the film is exploring that, but I'm just hearing that, I'm just going, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. No, it is, right? That is a function of living, especially now for us as millennials looking back on this generation and looking at our lives now. Like, it's...
We got fucked up!
Yeah. So I'm wondering, okay, so they have this fear for children in the future. What is the specific fear that they have for them?
Well, one of the things I think an important note that comes up a couple times is not just the fear for your children, it is the fear that your response, that you will not, not just that you cannot do anything, but that you will not be there to do what can be done. Because there are a couple scenes where they have to kind of juggle the safety of multiple children, particularly between Robbie and Carol Ann. Their bigger sister, Dana, is kind of a non-entity in this film almost. Because she's on the cusp of adulthood, she is somewhat self-reliant. But between Robbie and Carol Ann, they are pulled out to Robbie in the storm when the tree is eating him, which leads to them losing Carol Ann. Is because, particularly I think for Steve, he is portrayed as, you know, an ex-swimmer. He's a man's man. He's, you know, the big, strong dad. He carries his children. And so he has a limited set of things that he can do. He can exert physical strength. He doesn't really have, I think, really the metaphysical or the emotional steadiness that he does physically. And so he can save Robbie from the tree. And he probably could have saved Carol Ann from being pulled into the closet. We don't know. But he wasn't there. He didn't have the awareness. And that's kind of the horror that I think that note comes up a lot, is that you could have done something. Not that you can't do something. It's that you could have and you were not there. Or that, you know, you failed by circumstance or by neglect, not by inability. Because I think if you fail from inability, you are in some small way absolved. It still hurts, it still feels bad, but there's nothing you could have done.
Yeah.
Is something we say in comfort
a right. lot. Right, yeah.
You know, no one could have seen this coming. It's a freak accident, one in a million chance, you know. They were dead before you got there, you know. But to say, you know, you weren't there, that's something that, you know, a horror movie child says to their parents after they're dead.
Right. You know? Right.
It's you didn't save me versus you couldn't have saved me.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things that I think that connects up to is the idea of what the poltergeist is, right? Because the poltergeist in many ways is the manifestation of those sort of cultural fears. You know, like, yes, the parents are afraid that they are not going to be there, that there's some force that they could not have anticipated and didn't, like, are not able to be around to protect their children from. But I was thinking about what the poltergeist is, because the movie tells us very explicitly. The poltergeists are resentful souls trapped between this current plane and another plane. There are some ones who are benevolent that just don't know that they're dead. But there's also another group, which is very prominently featured in the film, that are resentful and deeply jealous of the living. And so what they do is they attempt to hurt them and torment them. So I'm wondering what you think that's about, too.
So there's a couple things here, and I want to tie this back to the whole not being there for your children thing for a second, because I think one of the nerves that this is touching on is this idea of random violence, because specifically, you know, violent crime, I think, has been trending down since, what, the 60s?
Something like that? Yes, that's right.
But actually, no, there was like a big spike in the 90s, I think, but We can get into social, geopolitical, historical data later, or maybe not even.
Yeah, well, but keep saying what you're saying about random violence in the 80s, because I've got stuff to support that.
Well, here is the thing. I think we need to remember this for the context, is this is the 80s. This is before cell phones. And, like, this is a lot of things, like, you know, Gen X and boomers will say, oh, when we were kids, we played in the streets until the streetlights went out. It went on. Then we came home. You know, it's like you have these kind of semi-autonomous children and you have these areas of no contact. And you were just expected to have that. You know, I've had a cell phone since I was, like, you know, like 12. So being out of communication with your children and with your parents is something that I think has become foreign to us. And it's not that you can't go without talking to them every hour or every 5 minutes or whatever the hell your comfort level is. It's that you know that you have the option. Because I think a parallel that I'm seeing in my mind is, you know, if your child was attacked between leaving for school and coming back, how would you know? Right? Yep. And the fact is that, like, that comes up in a lot of these narratives about, you know, child abductions or child killings, is that the police action or whatever response to it came after they learned that they were missing, which was hours after the fact. And so this idea of not being there at the opportune moment to help your children, I feel like this would have been, in kind of an abstract way, a nerve that they're tugging on.
Let's dig into that raw nerve a little bit more, though. This movie starts out with a montage of American national monuments in a scene, a bucolic scene of a white, suburban, middle-class nuclear family that's all set to the Star-Spangled Banner. These people and their home are presented to us as the American dream, as a kind of ideal standard from which life should be measured. Now, this movie is making a very distinct commentary on and is speaking to white suburbanites of the middle class during the 1980s. It's specifically addressing the idea of stranger danger, I think. And we can kind of get this from the narrative of the Poltergeist. For those of you who may have read other narratives of poltergeist hauntings, typically children don't disappear into walls and then their parents have to go and seek them out and find them. Now, you could say that that's just artistic license, but you also have to admit that the idea of the child disappearing, of the child calling out, "Mommy, mommy, please come find me, someone's going to hurt me," and the idea that there is a spiritual force on the other side that is potentially going to hurt this disappeared child, sounds an awful lot like a kidnapped child narrative. What I think this movie does is hybridizes poltergeist narratives with kidnapped child narratives. And the reason why it's doing that is because it's meditating on the idea of stranger danger. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, the suburbs were mostly white and mostly middle class. The reason for this being that in the wake of the 1960s movement to desegregate the U.S., the suburbs had remained largely untouched by most desegregation laws. In fact, the federal government under the Reagan administration, who had just come into power in 1981, actually said that the federal government would be overstepping their authority if they attempted to tell states to desegregate the suburbs. Also, one of their policies, and one of their real platforms was about crime and a crime wave that was supposedly impending in the US. Now, in this policy, the suburbs were defined as spaces of safety, as the ideal space of the American dream, and the cities were presented as heavily racialized spaces in which Black and Brown people were a contaminatory force who committed crimes, and also the urban poor were part of this narrative. So not just Black and Brown people, but also immigrants and poor white folks who lived in those communities as well. Now, this translated into a narrative throughout the 1980s about people coming from cities into the suburbs to commit crimes. And it's a heavily racialized and classed narrative, so this translated into some really terrible things. There were quite a few child kidnapping cases that happened in the 1980s, and they unfortunately were used to prop up this narrative that city dwellers were coming into suburban communities to commit these crimes. The crime wave was presented as a impending, like, horde of criminals just waiting to come into suburban communities from the city. So it's a kind of idea of the threat from without, if you will. I understand that the narrative in this movie is a bit more of a threat from within, right? Because it's about ghosts. But I think this movie is really sort of considering the idea of the ghost as an other, as a noisy spirit, as something that is fundamentally disruptive to this idea of the American dream that we're presented with at the beginning of the film. So that's some of the context for what's going on around the time that this movie is made. There's kidnapping cases, the Reagan administration is not so keen on desegregating the suburbs, and they've created some really pretty horribly racist narratives about crime in the US. And Poltergeist is in part attempting to work out this idea of stranger danger and the threat to young children and to the American nuclear family through that idea.
Yeah, and of course this also reflects that time the clowns with knives were stalking people in the streets. Oh, no, wait, that was recently. I still think my favorite, I want to share this, by the way, this does not relate to any kind of analysis of the film, but this just amuses me.
Yeah.
Because I remember reading a story on Twitter, I think it was on Twitter, where someone said that they had that exact same clown doll from Poltergeist, and after they saw the movie, they hated it and they were afraid of it, and they threw it away. And their parents found it in the trash, said, oh no, little Timmy accidentally threw away his favorite toy. I'm going to wash it, I'm going to set it up in his room.
Oh, God. That's horrifying.
I know, right?
That's
horrifying.
I know, right?
It's just, I love that story. I wish I knew. Like, I saw this years ago, and I'm just upset that I don't know where it is, so I can't, like, link it, because it was such a good story. The other, actually, that's a scare I was kind of expecting that didn't happen, is when he threw the shirt over the clown's face.
Yeah.
I was really expecting it to cut back to it and for the shirt to be gone.
Huh. That would have been good, Doc. If you had directed this, that would have been a good moment.
It would have been a very modern moment. The thing is, it's weird to watch this movie because our expectations for horror have changed so dramatically, and we expect something much snappier. And I think adding more scares per minute would take away from the anticipation of this film.
I also agree. I mean, I think this is a very well-crafted narrative, at least for the first half of the movie, in terms of the pacing of the scares. Now, there is an updated version of Poltergeist. I think it's from 2015. Have you seen that?
Yeah, the remake. I have not seen that.
Okay.
But off the top of my head, let's look at Poltergeist. And this is not a objective comparison, okay? But wait, Poltergeist 20.
Oh wow, they really focused on the clown.
Yeah. 4.9 stars versus 7.4 for the original.
Ooh.
I'm not holding my breath.
Ay.
I'm not holding my breath. But, like, okay, so going back to what poltergeists are, like, so because they specifically contrast poltergeists and hauntings.
Yes, they do.
So poltergeists are violence. Poltergeists are short-term hauntings that happen generally to people versus hauntings happening to place. So, in other words, I think a poltergeist is a traumatic, in the context of this film, a poltergeist is a traumatic haunting, and a haunting is a chronic haunting. You can live in a haunted house. You cannot live, if you live in a house with a poltergeist, something bad will happen. And this is about the family narrowly averting disaster.
Right.
Because if the poltergeist had succeeded at their, you know, mission, I guess you could call it, if they had operated and succeeded, Carol Ann would be gone. They would have a missing child. So I guess it's kind of an examination of, you know, like the discomfort. And since this is all about neighborhoods and this is about houses, this is about suburbia, this is like the difference between like a weird neighborhood or like a neighborhood that's kind of dodgier, kind of greasier, kind of like somehow imperfect. And a neighborhood where there is, you know, a criminal element or a problem that actually causes harm. Like, you know, I don't know, radioactive water or some shit, you know?
Yeah.
Is if you stay here, you will be harmed.
Right.
And you should recognize that danger.
Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. One of the other things that I really liked about this movie was that we don't actually know who the poltergeists are. We just know that they are, that they exist. The film gives us like some really teeny tiny clues. There is some jewelry that rains down on the parapsychology team at one point, which features a 100-year-old cameo, a watch that is definitely not Steve's. But we get no more detail about these people than that. And I think that's actually another thing that distinguishes a like this film from typical films about hauntings, because hauntings are so much about, okay, what's the backstory here? What happened, right? And this film is resisting that. It doesn't want to give us these people's stories because it doesn't have to. The site of the haunting itself is not their stories. That's not the problem. The problem is they don't realize they're dead. And so I think not giving us details about them is very enigmatic, and I really enjoyed that they did that.
I mean, this is kind of what we ended up talking about in The Ring, is this idea of what makes a haunting in, you know, an Eastern versus a Western film.
Yeah. And
what we have here is, this still, I think, falls very firmly kind of in the Western canon, but it shows some restraint in that we're not obsessing with the ghost. We are obsessing with the act that happened to desecrate them. We are focused on why they happened. So these ghosts are faceless, and I think from what we can gather from the text of the film is it was just everyone in the graveyard. It was people being buried for the last 100 years in this graveyard. They've all been kind of paved over, so they're going there. But so their identities aren't important. What is important is what happened to them. Now, that being said, in this context versus like, you know, like a Yuki Onna story where it's like, oh, here's a woman who was killed or drowned. That's a story that happens time and time again, that there are so many ghosts that you can just accept it. Is this was a singular act of desecration which created these restless spirits.
Right. And those stories that you mentioned are also about revenge. This is not about revenge in the Poltergeist. The Poltergeist is about visibility and like that ability to reach out and touch somebody and potentially harm them to let them know that they've trespassed. So it's not necessarily about getting revenge on the spouse, with the end calculus being the death of that person, right?
Yeah. But like I was talking with someone about kind of, you know, like that East-West divide, and I don't like that term East-West divide, but it's the closest shorthand we have right now.
It's problematic, but it's functional at this point, which sucks.
I guess.
Yeah.
I maybe to try and coin a phrase right here, a systemic versus an individualistic ghost. Maybe.
Potentially, yeah. Potentially.
But this is kind of a weird middle point where it is an individualistic act that creates a bunch of systemic ghosts. Because, like we said, in kind of the Western canon of ghost stories is ghosts are individuals. They are people. They are storied. And that is where we relate to them and we give them kind of the fictional or metaphysical, you know, agency to intrude upon the living, because it is a trespass. Whereas, you know, a systemic says there are these things that are done to people and there is this trauma that people experience that would necessarily sometimes stop them from moving on or create some kind of echo in the world. Whatever kind of metaphysical construct or paradigm you want to establish them in, that is a framework which exists, which people slowly fill. Whereas in this is, these are exceptional people or exceptional circumstances that create these storied things. And like, it's a weird thing. I want to, like, do an essay or something on this and kind of really more explore this. Because
yeah,
this is off the top of my head. This is off the cuff. And there's a lot of moving pieces that I don't quite have nailed down in terms of terminology or in terms of research that
that's
I would need
okay.
to do to
that's good.
Kind of establish things. But I feel like I'm onto something here.
I think that you definitely are. And also, don't be afraid of not having all the moving parts in place. Organic intellectuals do this kind of work all the time. And that's perfectly fine, especially if you're developing a theory about systemic versus individual hauntings. I think that's really wonderful work. So I'd say do it. One of the other things that I wanted to point to in this film as well is also part of what you were talking about there. The way that this film talks about the violation of a pact between people in the present and their ancestors. I thought that that was really kind of interesting, right? Because it's what's also at play in this film is sort of the idea that, you know, this family isn't really aware of what they're doing, and nobody else in the neighborhood is either. So it's kind of this historical narrative about how Americans are not really aware of the past, are not thinking about what other people went through, are not thinking about other people's lives, which is a very Reagan-esque thing. Reagan was constantly pointing back to the concept of our ancestors and the idea that they came to make America work, all of that sort of stuff. So it fits in very well. It's a critique of the suburbs in as much as it can be. But it does also fit well within the rhetorical strategies that Reagan was using to sort of get people on his side, if you will.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's interesting because you do compare this to The Exorcist. And uh-huh. This is 9 years later, so yeah. Almost a full decade.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting, actually, because specifically the way the film frames it is poltergeists surround people where hauntings are in places. And so it's kind of almost a direct response to that, where The Exorcist is, you know, the haunting of a person, basically.
Well, The Exorcist... So The Exorcist and this movie are dealing with two different tropes of the haunted child, right? So on the one hand, you have the child in this movie who is not yet aware of the rules of society. And so a lot of the things that she says are very uncanny, right? She doesn't know what the rules are. She doesn't know how to get out of the situation that she's in. And that's part of where the terror in this film comes from. Within The Exorcist, it's about the child who is aware of the rules of society, but whose body is taken over by an entity that is going to violate those rules no matter what. So, yeah, it's a weirder version of a poltergeist haunting, almost.
Yeah. And, like, I think there is a reason that they're mentioned. Like, these are all reasons why they're mentioned in the same breath.
Yeah.
Because... when I look, and I don't remember The Exorcist that clearly.
Mm-hmm. I didn't either, evidently. Feel bad about that, but whatever.
Yeah. Where was I going with this? Fuck.
You were saying that The Exorcist is different from this film to a certain extent.
I think what I'm trying to say is that the poltergeist kind of builds on a very similar core, but addressing very different, you know, kind of insecurities and, you know, I guess horror points might be.
Very much so. Yeah.
It's a weird, like, trying to coin a phrase kind of phrase, but it kind of works for society.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's kind of all I've got to say on this one is... there's a lot to... besides, I think, weirdly enough, for once, I'm not a fan of a lot of the practical effects. In the last half of this movie, you know, when you got graves popping out, it turns a little bit Indiana Jonesy for me.
Oh, yeah, it definitely does. And Spielberg had evidently a very heavy hand on making this movie, so I would expect that.
So, you know, that's just a change of pace for me, because normally I'm like, oh, look at the sets, look at the practical effects, look at the puppets, oh my god.
No, it becomes like, more like...
Could we have stuck with the weird ethereal crap, please? Thank you.
Yeah, because this went very, like, haunted house towards the end of it, like, almost on a roller coaster ride with graves popping
Yeah, when the house
side.
Kind of imploded into a singularity, I was kind of honestly expecting it to grow a face and, like, eat the real estate developer.
Oh, man.
Because he was just standing there like the whole time, like you do, you know, like that's the kind of thing a bad guy does before he gets eaten by his comeuppance.
Right.
So, yeah. So is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up?
No, I think we got all of it pretty much.
All right. So let's message to Tobe Hooper. Dear director this. And
dear Tobe. Toby.
Hey, Tobe. Okay, yeah, I'll go first this time. Hey, Tobe, this was pretty good. You know, I like it. I don't really have much to say, and he hasn't been working much recently, so it's not like I feel like there is a I think living entity is the wrong word, but a working director that I necessarily want to dialogue with.
But it's he's not alive, Doc. He died in 2017. Oh, he's dead? That's why he's not working. Yeah.
I didn't catch that. Yeah. I feel really bad now. Because I looked at his IMDb and I scrolled down to, okay, last villain 2013. Okay, kind of sparse until then. Well, now I just feel like a dick. Dear Tobe Hooper, please don't haunt my ass. Love, Doc.
Dear Toby Hooper, because I refuse to call you Tobe, I hope that you can hear this from the great beyond. This was a really enjoyable film for me. I liked all of the thoughts that it provoked and all the discussion that we ended up having about it. I think it's great for that reason. I like some of the jump scares and some of the practical effects, despite them perhaps not being, you know, on the same parallel with The Thing, but that's fine. I dug it. I think this is a pretty good movie. Maybe we should watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I have no idea. We'll see.
Hell yeah.
We'll see.
All right. Anyways, this has been the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Silvio Emery. You guys can follow me on Twitter at DoubleDocMD. I stream video games on Twitch at DoubleDocMD. And you can follow our show Twitter at Movie Morgue Cast, as well as on Facebook and other places, yada yada. A lot of stuff in the show description. Annie, where can people find you and your work?
People can find me on Twitter. I'm at Lights and Music, where I post pictures of my dog. And I also retweet academic articles and stuff that I find interesting and that other nerds might too. So come visit me.
You can also find me on the Cenotaph on Twitch at You Do Not Meet in an Inn. I'll probably actually just post that as a URL. That just seems like a lot easier of a thing to do. Just join the actual play. I'm really excited about that. Our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factopus. You can find a link to their EP down below. And Tommy, the lead from that, has actually started a new band, King Tiger Zero, which is, I believe, releasing an album soon, so I'm really excited about that.
Oh, awesome.
Anyways, we're supported by listeners, patrons, and friends. If you guys want to support us, tell your friends, listen, subscribe, and review wherever good podcasts are found. And if you want to take it an extra step further, we have a Patreon at patreon.com/doubledocmd. Regardless, thank you for all your support and love so far. We can't do this without you guys. We love you all. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.